sometimes for years, to return to war-torn homelands. Tens of millions are considered internally displaced within their own countries. Another 150 million are considered migrant workers, who are, in a sense, refugees of poverty. To call this exodus a crisis is actually a misnomer, since migration is a constant state of being for a considerable portion of the population. But geopolitical flashpoints have flared around particular fault lines between Global North and Global South. One is the United States-Mexico border, where tens of thousands of Central American refugees, many of them mothers and children seeking asylum, have entered since 2014. The other major north-south crossing is along the borders of southern Europe, from the Mediterranean coast of Italy to the Balkans, where hundreds of thousands of Syrian and Afghan refugees have thronged by land and sea. The shores of Australia have also drawn a refugee influx in recent years, washing up on boats from troubled areas around the Indian Ocean. Patterns of sexual violence perpetrated against these migrants are virtually impossible to measure in strictly numerical terms. Overall, aid agencies and researchers report that, on typical routes of irregular migration, gender-based violence is endemic. Sexual violations, primarily experienced by transitory women and girls who make up a large minority of the global migrant population, thread through a prism of structural violence with roots on either side of the border. The borders migrants traverse are sites of immense suffering, yet each body on the borderline is a contested space where refugees negotiate security or dispossession, depending on who is doing the crossing and who gets crossed. Calculated risk. When asked, many migrants say the journey itself is no more dangerous than staying still. People do not move out of ignorance or sheer panic. They respond rationally to irrational events. Why remain in place when oppression or calamity has destroyed every reason to stay? War, genocide, ethnic persecution, and ecological disaster present migrants with an impossible choice between familiar violence and unknown danger. Though women are a minority within the overall migrant population, in countries stricken by war and poverty, the culture and structural constraints of gender oppression may be all the more reason to want to leave. A rural pregnant teenager orphaned by civil war can either migrate internally to seek factory work in the city or try her luck on a smuggling boat. She might be misled about the relative risks of the overseas journey, but knows she faces tragic stakes whether and wherever she stays or goes. Jumping on a dilapidated boat bound for the Italian coastline, where about 1 in 88 migrants died last year in 2016, or crossing the Arizona desert where thousands have vanished over the past decade, is a calculated risk. And the risk of sexual abuse is seen as an inevitable cost of political trespass. On the vast, heavily patrolled corridor along the U.S.-Mexico border, aid organizations estimated in 2014 that 80% of women and girls had been raped in transit, an apparent increase from a 2010 Amnesty International study showing that 60% were raped. The pattern coincided with a recent spike in the number of young girls traveling alone from Central America to the United States. Victimization in transit is, however, just one extremity of a phalanx of gender-based violence engulfing Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. The three small Central American countries at the core of the regional exodus have among the world's highest rates of female homicide, an outgrowth of transnational drug war policies and decades of political and economic crisis. Girls are regularly coerced into gangs or threatened with rape. Mothers have stopped sending their daughters to school to keep them safe. And when hiding indoors gets too dangerous, youth go north, joining thousands of unaccompanied children and teens, marching alone to the border, violable at every turn. As human rights lawyer Elvira Gordillo explained in an interview with Splinter, typically, migrants, quote, know the price to pay for getting to the United States is being sexually violated. On the other side of the Atlantic, migrants from the Middle East and Africa have washed up on the Italian and Greek coastlines and thronged to the rim of Eastern and Central Europe. While thousands have died en route to Fortress Europe, many of those who reach the borders of the world's wealthiest economic bloc end up languishing indefinitely in detention centers as they plow through the asylum bureaucracy. A churning shadow population of irregular migrants floating through European cities is filtered into a professionalized humanitarian aid regime, or they fall into the underground economy's smuggling and human trafficking industries. European Union ministers, meanwhile, remain continually deadlocked in negotiating a continent-wide humanitarian resettlement policy, reducing refugee bodies to political talking points in Brussels, while rape survivors may be left to camp outdoors along border fences. Survival rape. The worst violations often happen before migrants reach Europe. On the route through Africa to the tip of Libya, which is the main hub for smuggling boats across the Mediterranean and itself engulfed in civil conflict, sexual violence becomes a routine hazard, prompting women to pre-inject contraceptives to prevent pregnancy. Rape is endemic at the migrant camps around the Libyan port, sometimes in official facilities, other times just in repositories where smugglers hold human cargo before sending them off to sea. An Eritrean woman described to Amnesty International how rape was systematized at her camp in Libya. Quote, the guards would drink and smoke hashish, cannabis, and then come in and choose which women they wanted and take them outside. The women tried to refuse, but when you have a gun pointed at your head, you don't really have a choice if you want to survive. I was raped twice by three men. I didn't want to lose my life. Vulnerability to sexual violence also hinges on other social hierarchies. Wealthier refugees have the money and connections to purchase access to safer routes. Black African migrants are often subjected to more abuse than lighter-skinned counterparts. Labor and sexual exploitation blur into each other, generating subcategories of rape like survival sex or protection sex. In a study of African migration into Europe in recent years, researchers Sharon Pickering and Allison Gerard quote one migrant, Aziza, describing a climate of sexual coercion while held under armed guard in Libya. Quote, the living situation is difficult because you are not free. There are people standing over you, and you have to negotiate to leave. Some people pay money to leave, others provide sex, or are raped. In a UN-led study, Oumo recalled the banality of transactional sex, which she undertook twice to obtain a fake passport, and then to get a spot on a smuggling boat from Turkey to Greece. Quote, I had no choice. I fear that I will go crazy. The notion of freely offered consent becomes murky. The cost of returning home, rather than moving on, is too high. Transactional sex can also serve as a legitimizing means of providing economic security. The devastating poverty facing Syrian refugee families in Jordan has led to an epidemic of child marriage, in a practical barter of youth impurity for marital protection, often between young teens and much older men. The sex work industry runs parallel to marriage as another institution of survival sex. However, because prostitution is associated with poverty and social transgression, refugees who enter the sex trade, often because they cannot find other work, risk social stigma and imprisonment, in contrast to wives kept secure in subjugation. The question of choice dissolves at these social peripheries. A woman's agency is mediated by basic needs, and sex becomes the last remaining vehicle for negotiating survival. Whether it happens to Syrian refugees or to survivors of gang warfare in Honduras, sexual violation on the migrant trail is a cruel symbol of a community's dispossession and mass loss of dignity. Yet the institutionalization of sexual predation reveals a certain political economy of statelessness, in which rape serves as a currency of last resort for both sides of a social fissure. At the crossing, the migrant is never really charting her own path, but is being pushed by geopolitical currents. In the care of strangers. Even in the supposedly more civilized humanitarian settings that Western countries offer migrants, rape culture is reproduced in binaries of security and deviance. Migratude extends relationships of colonial dominion. At temporary shelters in the global north, sexual exploitation and domestic abuse persist, often because they are normalized into a given camp's everyday functioning. Reported abuses have come from both migrants and security officers. Even in the better funded, more regulated detention centers in Europe, women face profound risks of sexual trauma, along with social isolation and barriers to mental health services. Refugees may soon be barred altogether from European territory. By the end of 2016, public backlash against migrants in the West prompted EU ministers to route thousands of Syrian refugees from Greece into even more precarious migrant camps in Turkey, effectively closing the border and, according to humanitarian groups, denying countless trauma survivors crucial relief. In the U.S., Raquel, a former detainee from Central America, told aid lawyers about fleeing gang violence in her homeland to escape to what she thought would be a life of relative safety, only to wind up in federal detention and being sexually abused by an immigration officer. Quote, "I thought he was going to kill me. I thought I should have stayed in my home country if my life was going to end like this, because at least I would have had more time with my children. He got in the cage with me and started unzipping his pants and pulling off my clothes. He exposed himself to me. He was angry that I would not take off my clothes." Though she was eventually freed from detention and sought asylum, she remained traumatized by the abuse endured at the gates of refuge. Quote, "I left one problem in my home country and encountered another one here," she testified. "I felt afraid of everyone on the street, men and women, especially if they came near me or touched me. I cried at night and had a hard time falling asleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw him." The border management regime in Australia, too, has given rise to a miniature colony in the isolated offshore detention site of Nauru, a tiny atoll where several hundred boat people, including scores of children, have been dumped. The facility is largely kept out of public view, but thousands of recently leaked internal staff reports going back to 2013 include accounts of sexual assault and attacks on children and reveal layers of complicity threaded through the humanitarian bureaucracy. According to a 2015 Guardian report, several detained children reported being molested by security guards, but their documented complaints were apparently quietly downgraded to less serious violations. A young Iranian woman was found traumatized, bitten, and bruised outside the facility in May 2015. Then came two suicide attempts, first the victim, then her mother, who was isolated in detention while her daughter was hospitalized. A Somali detainee who reported she had become pregnant from rape sought an abortion but was initially blocked from traveling to Australia for the hospital procedure. Meanwhile, despite public outcry, officials have stalled on prosecuting abuse cases or reforming detention policy. But the conservative Australian government's years of silence in Nauru don't just reflect embarrassment or incompetence. Systemic silence is what the government had budgeted for all along. From 2013 to 2016, it had reportedly sunk about $10 billion into its border protection system just to keep the refugees offshore. Imagining migrants. In contrast to the wall of silence around rape and migration, rape culture has entered the mainstream Western political discourse on immigration policy, albeit at a distorted angle. Migrant, black, brown, or Muslim men are stereotyped as rapists in Europe and the U.S., stoking fears they arrived eager to prey on the honor of native-born white women. On New Year's Eve 2015, the festivities on the streets of the city of Cologne, Germany, were disrupted by a rash of reports of public sexual assaults against women. Police and media outlets quickly aired suspicions that Arab and North African refugee men were to blame. The allegations inflamed public fears that sexually deviant refugee youth posed a security threat in German cities. Signs scrawled with "Rapeugees" surfaced at protest rallies. Ironically, conservative pundits who have often downplayed other issues of gender-based violence then zealously decried the, quote, rape culture supposedly inherent in Muslim societies. The media frenzy paralleled Donald Trump's scaremongering on the 2016 campaign trail about Mexican rapists streaming across the border. Some lambasted liberals for softening their vigilance toward migrants due to naive political correctness. In subsequent weeks, media analysis of the coverage of the sexual assault stories revealed not a systemic pattern of migrant attacks, but rather a preponderance of rumor-driven reports and hyperbole. The chivalric denouncement of migrant men, however, had less to do with the facts or protecting European women's dignity than with reinforcing the cultural patriarchy undergirding it. The vilification of Muslim men and criminalization of migration in general in the global north has proven profoundly destabilizing and alienating, resulting in, among other problems, a regressive gendering of resettlement and integration issues. The current policy discourse around migration policy tends to distinguish women and children as a separate category of victimhood, those deemed worthy of rescue, from men and boys, who are seen as potential perverts or terrorists. European aid and asylum regulations, for example, have typically excluded male Syrian refugees, with the exception of children, seniors, and people with disabilities, on national security grounds. But advocates say this division leads to dehumanization of all migrants. When women and children are exclusively prioritized in humanitarian resettlement, the government might end up unraveling the very social bonds that are integral to rebuilding their lives. Under conventional relocation programs, refugee populations are separated into one-dimensional portraits of public charges or criminals. Gender inequality is intensified, even for the rescued women and children, when host countries offer few opportunities for refugees to truly restore their social fabric as cohesive communities, with their own cultural and political integrity. The structural violence besieging refugees echoes the legacy of imperialism in the global south. On the landscape of systemic mass dispossession, rape culture is not foreign, but rather essential to the Western worldview. Rape is integral to the cultures of war, colonization, and forced displacement that have turned gender oppression and sexual violence into a global currency of desperation. Noting the structural deficits in humanitarian resources for treatment and monitoring of refugee rape survivors, psychologist Katie Thomas wrote, quote, "Government and non-state actor combatants usually share a low valuation of women. No other physical wound with injuries as severe as those perpetrated by sexual violence could be ignored or deprioritized without international outcry. We speak of rape and migration as an unimaginable experience, a transgression relegated to the margins of civilization. But we can't make sense of rape culture more broadly or the meaning of gender and migration until we understand that both the social order within borders and the chaos outside them fold into a single binary that cannot hold. Refugees' stories reflect the complexity of navigating the social vacuums between states. Yet the scourge of rape isn't rooted in the culture that crosses the border, but the culture of borders themselves. The line separating one society from another, and us from them, is what we make of it. The border crossers' never-ending quest for real security turns on the common ground we share, not the boundaries between us."
Wiping the Stain Clean by Gabrielle Union. 24 years ago, I was raped at gunpoint in the cold, dark back room of the Payless shoe store where I was then working. 2 years ago, I signed on to a brilliant script called The Birth of a Nation to play a woman who was raped. 1 month ago, I was sent a story about Nate Parker, the very talented writer, director, and star of this film. 17 years ago, Nate Parker was accused and acquitted of sexual assault. 4 years ago, the woman who accused him committed suicide. Different roads circling one brutal, permeating stain on our society. A stain that is finally etched into my own history. Rape is a wound that throbs long after it heals, and for some of us, the throbbing gets too loud. Post-traumatic stress syndrome is very real and chips away at the soul and sanity of so many of us who have survived sexual violence. Since Nate Parker's story was revealed to me, I have found myself in a state of stomach-churning confusion. I took this role because I related to the experience. I also wanted to give a voice to my character, who remains silent throughout the film. In her silence, she represents countless black women who have been and continue to be violated. Women without a voice, without power. Women in general, but black women in particular. I knew I could walk out of our movie and speak to the audience about what it feels like to be a survivor. My compassion for victims of sexual violence is something that I cannot control. It spills out of me like an instinct rather than a choice. It pushes me to speak when I want to run away from the platform, when I'm scared, confused, ashamed. I remember this part of myself and must reach out to anyone who will listen, other survivors or even potential perpetrators. As important and groundbreaking as this film is, I cannot take these allegations lightly. On that night, 17-odd years ago, did Nate have his date's consent? It's very possible he thought he did. Yet, by his own admission, he did not have verbal affirmation. And even if she never said no, silence certainly does not equal yes. Although it's often difficult to read and understand body language, the fact that some individuals interpret the absence of a no as a yes is problematic at least, criminal at worst. That's why education on this issue is so vital. As a black woman raising brilliant, handsome, talented young black men, I am cognizant of my responsibility to them and their future. My husband and I stress the importance of their having to walk an even straighter line than their white counterparts. A lesson that is heartbreaking and infuriating, but mandatory in the world we live in. We have spent countless hours focused on manners, education, the perils of drugs. We teach them about stranger danger and making good choices. But recently, I've become aware that we must speak to our children about boundaries between the sexes and what it means to not be a danger to someone else. To that end, we are making an effort to teach our sons about affirmative consent. We explain that the onus is on them to explicitly ask if their partner consents. And we tell them that a shrug or a smile or a sigh won't suffice. They have to hear yes. Regardless of what I think may have happened that night 17 years ago after reading all 700 pages of the trial transcript, I still don't actually know. Nor does anyone who was not in that room. But I believe that the film is an opportunity to inform and educate so that these situations cease to occur on college campuses, in dorm rooms, in fraternities, in apartments, or anywhere else young people get together to socialize. I took this part in this film to talk about sexual violence, to talk about this stain that lives on in our psyches. I know these conversations are uncomfortable and difficult and painful, but they are necessary. Addressing misogyny, toxic masculinity, and rape culture is necessary. Addressing what should and should not be deemed consent is necessary. Think of all the victims who, like my character, are silent. The girl sitting in their dorm room scared to speak up. The wife who was abused by her husband. The woman attacked in an alley. The child molested. Countless souls broken from trans violence attacks. It is for you that I am speaking. This is real. We are real. Sexual violence happens more often than anyone can imagine. And if the stories around this film do not prove and emphasize this, then I don't know what does. It is my hope that we can use this as an opportunity to look within, to open up the conversation, to reach out to organizations that are working hard to prevent these kinds of crimes, and to support its victims, to donate time or money, to play an active role in creating a ripple that will change the ingrained misogyny that permeates our culture, and to eventually wipe the stain clean.
What We Didn't Say by Liz Rosma. The bathroom is like every other bathroom. I'm waiting in a line, silently and awkwardly, like you do when you are waiting for something that isn't interesting. On one side, a lady stares at a tile in the corner of the room, politely ignoring the presence of everyone else. I stand out in these lines. I am almost a foot taller than everyone else. On the other side of me, a woman stares up in disbelief, and she blurts out, "Wow, you are really tall. Do you play basketball?" At work, people ask, "Do you play basketball?" At the grocery store, in the checkout line, people ask, "Do you play basketball?" At the gym, I'm covered in sweat stains, and people still ask, "Do you play basketball?" Mostly, I do not answer them. I played basketball for one season, my sophomore year of high school. Mostly I remember drills and sweating, running suicides, and how nervous I was about messing up. Our coach was a butt slapper. He slapped me. It was so sudden, I didn't even react. All I had was surprise. I told myself, this just happens in sports, butt slapping. It's just kind of a thing, not a big deal. Mostly. It has happened many times since then. But that was the only time I ever felt degraded or ashamed. All the other times, it didn't feel bad. I don't even remember the name of that coach, but I remember what he said. It's like there's a corner of a page folded there in my mind. When I think about it, I turn right to it. And I remember his whistle, the sound of it during suicides when we would run until we felt like we were going to puke. The other things fall out of focus, and what's left is only words. He says, "Put it up nice and easy, just the way your husband will like it. He'll thank me later." What he said made me want to puke. Everyone looked grossed out, but everyone stayed silent. One day, he didn't show up to one of our games. The other coaches told us he wouldn't be coming back because he had behaved inappropriately toward a student in a PE class. The locker room was quiet, and we left quietly. No one asked, "Did he do anything to you?" We didn't say. He behaved inappropriately towards us. I took it, and I put it away. I didn't talk to my parents about it. I didn't talk to my closest friends about it. And I didn't talk to my teammates about it. I just put it away. I put it away until it came back to me. When the It's On Us campaign showed up in my Facebook feed, I had already graduated from college. I read comment after horrible comment, some of them by people I knew. They said things like, "Protect our sons from loose women. Sexual harassment isn't really that common. Here's Obama again to save us from a problem we don't have. As a man, I've never done anything like this in my life, and I'm insulted." I looked at them and I said to myself, "Those poor women. I'm glad something like that has never happened to me." And then it was there, that folded page, reminding me that I was part of those. When I think about it, my mind spins. I have circles of questions, whys and what-ifs. Why didn't we say anything? Did we think it wasn't that bad? Did that really count? Why didn't we call this what it really was? In my mind, I see a staircase. It is infinite and heading both up and down at the same time. Up it march lips that are sewn shut. Upward they march, silent in their journey. Upward, there are a million of them. They say, "Shh, shh, quiet. You must be quiet. They must be quiet." They are so heavy with what they do not say. Upside down and underneath the staircase, a parade of metal gym whistles runs into an abyss. They say, "We are your chances to say something. We are all gone." There's a tape held around my mouth as if by a spell I do not understand. A halo of whys. Why? 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 When I started to think about harassment, more memories jumped out at me, like other folded pages in the book. I don't think I forgot them. I think I buried them, as if they were dead. But they are not, and they come back so suddenly. I bent over to get something from the bottom shelf in the walk-in, and he trapped me there, bent over in front of him, his crotch right behind me, and then he laughed. I couldn't move. The only way out was to back up into him. "Move," I snarled. He said, "God, what's your problem?" Like I offended him for not getting his great joke. Later, I said, "I don't like him." And they said, "He's a nice guy," with a shrug. And I said, "I just don't like him." And when these things come back to me and I see people say, "It's not really that big of a deal," or "It doesn't happen that often," I see those lips on that staircase with so many things to say, shouting, and those whistles screeching, and I think, maybe if I tell people, and we tell people, all the stories that we have buried, then a 15-year-old on a basketball team will say, "This is that bad. It is harassment, and I am telling everyone." And that is what I hope for, that by digging these things up, I might help others find a voice where I lost mine. I'm standing outside in the dark, waiting to buy tickets for the movie. The people in front of me stare at their phones, but the guy behind me looks up and says, "Do you play basketball?"
I Said Yes, by Anthony Frame. The opening sequence of our wedding video consists of a montage of photographs. First of me, then of my wife, then of the two of us, tracking our lives from our separate childhoods until we met, and a year later, we're married. The first time we watched, my wife squeezed my arm and giggled at the early snapshots of me. A couple photos of a chunky toddler, and then a few school pictures leading toward junior high. In the first few, the boy, small and stout, poses without embarrassment, pinching his own fat cheeks and offering the camera a wide, worshipful smile. In the sixth grade picture, though, the boy has changed. A sudden growth spurt had lengthened and distorted my face to something like a tree knot. A set of glasses, the circumference of softballs, seemed to match the scruffled hair I had refused to comb. And my baby smile had fallen, scrunched down into as close to a scowl as I, in my privileged private school uniform, could muster. My wife paused the video and looked at me, her eyes darting as they scanned my face. "I know," I said. "I'd heard this 100 times from my mother over the years. My smile's gone." "No, it's not that." She kept looking at me, eye to eye, and held my hand. "It's your eyes. They're so..." Was that the year it happened? I was asleep in my friend's bed. The night was cooler than summer should have permitted, but he decided to sleep in the hammock in his backyard anyway. I, on the other hand, needed blankets and walls to keep away potential wind and rain, so, in a t-shirt and boxers, I stumbled sleepily inside and into his room, anticipating the holiday fireworks and grilled corn and classic rock blasting from his dad's stereo. The blankets may have been too much, so I was still in between sleep and wakefulness when his father came in the room, sometime after midnight. I heard the stutter shuffle of his feet first, then the bottle slipping from his hand, bouncing off the hardwood floor, somehow managing not to shatter. He coughed. He swore. I tried to keep my eyes shut, thinking he just wanted to see that I was sleeping safely, comfortably. But he groaned as I felt his weight fall at the foot of the bed, a sound like the wolves at the zoo. And I could feel him as his weight shifted. I could feel him as he leaned over me. When I opened my eyes, his beard was inches from my face, damp with sweat and from the stale beer I could smell in his breath. His eyes were wide, so wide it was as if they couldn't blink, and they scanned my face, my hair, my ears, my mouth. His lips started off as a straight horizontal line, then curved to a crescent moon smile before becoming a small hole as he saw the worry on my face. He brushed his fingers across my cheek, along my shoulder, and down my chest, pulling the blanket off as he went. I opened my mouth, but he put a finger to his lips. "Shh, it's okay. I'm gonna show you something." With one hand over my mouth, He pulled the blanket off and slid his fingers in the flap of my boxers. I crunched my eyes shut. "Don't worry. We're gonna make you a big boy." At first, the way he stroked my penis was soft and quiet, using his filed fingernails until I had an erection. Then he grabbed and pumped, his calloused palms rubbing raw against me. I turned my head, breathing hard and fast at the moon through the window. Somewhere, nearby, someone had started the holiday early, and flashes of fireworks broke through the darkness. And he kept whispering wetly the whole time, beer-stained spittle dripping on my face, his grin growing, growing. "That's good. Good. Good boy, yes?" It was the first time I'd ejaculated while awake. When it was over, he took his hand from my mouth and smiled, wide, crooked. He sniffed my semen, stuck to his fingers. "There. Good boy. Didn't that feel good?" In my all-boys high school, the walls were white. The floor and ceiling were white. The school was scrubbed meticulously every evening. Cleanliness is next to godliness, we were told, and we were always to have our thoughts on the Lord. Sports were encouraged by the priests and principal because, as they explained, vigorous exercise is the best way to shunt aside sexual thoughts and urges. Neither worked. I tried to hide in plain sight, my head low, my voice quiet, my every move completely average, even my grades, so as not to attract attention. I surrounded myself with loud friends around whom I could become invisible, nondescript and forgettable. It was the most successful survival technique I'd found after I'd been molested. The only one of us who could have been called cool was Josh. Tall, leather jacket, hair dripping with grease, he was our grunge god. From him I learned to swear like a man, to drop the words fuck, bitch, and pussy in my sentences as smoothly and as frequently as the word the. He was a hard boy, even in his button-down shirts and clip-on ties. He smacked us on the backs and asses at every opportunity, then called out to passing math geeks. "Off to your formulas and butt sex, fags. Want to take skinny with you?" he'd say, pointing at me. "Fucking pussies." "God, how old are the Olsen twins now?" he asked at lunch halfway through our freshman year, pushing his hair behind his ears. "I'm too ready to jerk off to them." I stared out the window and watched as the groundskeeper circled the lawn on his riding mower. Josh looked around the table at us while drumming his fingers on the table. "Come on, they're still jailbait, right? Don't tell me none of you haven't thought about it." Someone murmured that if it's in our heads, there can't be anything wrong, and a debate over pubic hair quickly raged next to me. Josh looked across the table at me. He couldn't have known that my stomach was tightening, that the night before I'd dreamed of razor blades and of a man masturbating me, or that whenever I touched myself, I couldn't help but think about the moon and fireworks. "Which one do you jerk off to, skinny? And don't try saying they look the same, or I'll know for sure you're a fag." I pushed my lunch across the table toward him. "Come on, we all know you're doing it." Could I tell him? I'd had 4 years to figure out how to tell someone, anyone, what had happened to me. But Josh didn't give me the chance. "Yeah, I knew it," he said, without waiting for me to answer. He pointed and laughed. "You love to jerk off, don't you, you sick shit?" It's hard to describe what we did as hazing, at least at first. Two other sophomores were just messing around a little with Steven, the smallest freshman on our cross-country team. Waiting for our parents outside the school building, we pushed him aside as he was changing from his cleats to his tennis shoes. Fred held him against the wall while I grabbed a shoe and tossed it to Matt. We played keep away for a couple minutes, Steven trying to catch the shoe as it floated above his head. He was laughing, enjoying the game, or at least enjoying being somehow included. When we finally let Steven catch his shoe, Matt nudged him on the shoulder and told him he was a good sport. Steven, crouched on the ground and sliding his foot into his Nike, smiled up at us, his grin wide, his hair scattered across his head from all the jumping. I hated him, suddenly. I hated how small he was. I hated how willing he was to play along. I hated his weakness. Before I knew what I was doing, I shoved him hard against the concrete. I knelt on top of him, shouting, "Fucking pussy! Grow up, asshole!" I kept pushing him against the ground, even as I heard him crying. I wanted to hear him squeal. Matt and Fred pulled me off him, shouting at me. "What the hell's wrong with you, man?" they yelled as they threw me against the building. But I was gone, watching myself watch Steven picking himself off the ground and wiping the tears from his eyes. The assistant coach came outside, surveyed the situation, and after Matt and Fred told him what had happened, dragged me into his office. As he screamed at me, I started sobbing. I couldn't explain myself because I didn't understand. I had never felt that kind of rage before. I had no idea where it came from. I couldn't comprehend what had happened. In between my tears, I tried to apologize, but it felt like my mouth was sewn shut. It felt like a hand was pressed over my lips. It felt like I couldn't breathe. I prayed the coach would see, prayed that he'd hear the fireworks in my head, prayed that he'd take me in his arms and tell me everything would finally be okay. He looked at me and shook his head. "Pathetic," he said. "Tell me, do you feel like a big man now?" In our junior year, we threw a party at Aaron's house. Just five of us with pizza and pay-per-view professional wrestling. We each brought a case of Natty Light, and Josh brought his girlfriend, Kate. She stood 2 inches taller than him and wore a tight white tank top and jeans with ripped holes around the curves of her ass. As we drank and watched the steroids on display, he whispered in her ear, and when she laughed, he wrapped his arm around her waist and squeezed her breasts, all while watching us watching him. Halfway through the night, the rain came. I could hear the wind blowing against the aluminum siding, a whistle without a discernible tune. Josh nudged Kate and pointed at Aaron. She looked and nodded, then moved next to Aaron and started licking his ear. Josh told Aaron to stand up, and as he did, Kate grabbed his crotch and rubbed. Josh had his hand in one of the holes in her jeans. She smoothed out Aaron's khakis to show his erection, but she was watching me. The beer in my hand had gone flat. It tasted rancid in my mouth. My stomach tightened, and I could feel the night's pizza pushing its way up my throat. "You want to go next, skinny?" Kate asked, blowing me a kiss. I moved upstairs as fast as I could to the bathroom and heard Josh's howling laugh behind me. "Not him. Everyone knows Skinny's as queer as a unicorn." I didn't throw up, but when I came out of the bathroom, Josh was waiting for me. "You all right?" I nodded and apologized. Said I was sorry for being a lightweight. We sat down at the top of the stairs and he took my hand. "Dude, you know I love you, right?" I just looked at him. I hadn't noticed before how blue his eyes were. Hadn't known before that eyes could have freckles. He took off my glasses and brushed his fingers along my eyebrows, then through my weak attempt at a goatee. "Jesus, you've got a lot of hair." He put my glasses back on and smiled. "I mean it, man. I love you. More than any of those other guys. More than her even, and I fuck her. It doesn't matter that you're a fag. I mean, what do I care, right?" He took my hand again, and I watched him rub the flap of skin between my thumb and index finger. I wanted to love him back, but then a cut on his thumb scraped against my hand, just a slight tug, and I could feel those calloused hands pulling the blanket away. I could smell beery breath again. Josh didn't notice any change in me, or, if he did, he ignored it and kept talking. "I just want you to know, anyone gives you any shit, and I mean anyone, you let me know, 'cause I love you, bro." Downstairs, they were laughing, and Kate hollered for us to hurry up. "You know, you could sleep with her if you wanted," Josh went on. "She'd let you. I don't know, but maybe that'd help or something." I shook my head and stood to leave, but he kept talking. Well, you wouldn't have to be alone. I could be there. It could be, like, the three of us. And if you're not into her, you know, you could be into me or something. I thought about Kate downstairs, tried to imagine her overhearing this conversation. I tried to think of her eyes, but couldn't picture their color. I didn't even know if her hair color was natural, but Josh was offering her to me like she was some toy we could share. Or maybe I was the toy. I thanked him. I even apologized to him, though I felt sick about the offer, about what Josh must think about Kate, what he must think about me. I started walking down the steps, but Josh didn't move. He just sat there, hands folded as if in prayer. He looked down at me. Tony, you do love me too, right? Later, after everyone had passed out, I struggled to sleep. The batting of the couch seemed to dig into my legs, and bright spots danced in the darkness whenever I closed my eyes. The storm had passed, taking the wind and the front with it, and I missed the numbing noise. Upstairs, I could hear feet rustling in the hall, moving from room to bathroom and back, not bothering to try to walk lightly. After a couple hours, Kate came downstairs. She was still wearing the tank top, but had left her jeans behind, and her white panties clung tight to her hips. She started when she saw me sitting up, then said she needed a smoke and asked if I wanted to keep her company. Outside, the air had turned crisp. Most of the clouds had moved on, and through the suburban trees, we watched the stars fading in and out behind the city's atmosphere. Kate lit her cigarette, inhaled deeply, and blew a heavy column of smoke into the air. I know you're not gay, she said, offering me a cigarette. I declined. Never said I was, I told her. And I think Josh is the only one who actually thinks I am. Doesn't really make a difference. It's just easier not to say anything. Doesn't it bother you when they call you a fag? I shrugged. They're gonna call me that anyway. Sitting next to her, I could see her blonde hair was a dye job, and not a very good one. Strands of brown hiding near her scalp tried to come out, creating a spiderweb effect along her head that could only be seen up close. She dragged again, and as she blew the smoke out, said, "Insomnia's a bitch, huh?" She rubbed her arms, which were covered in goosebumps. I wished I had a jacket for her, wished for better arms, for hands that could hold her without grabbing at her body. She flicked her cigarette into the grass. I blame my dad, she said, suddenly. I'm pretty sure he was the only one happier than me when I started growing these tits. She watched me out of the corner of her eye, if you know what I mean. She then looked at me, straight on, and I saw my face reflected in the brown surface of her eyes. I wanted to tell her that Josh was using her. Tell her about all the things he said when she wasn't around, how she was fun even if she is sloppy seconds, how he loves to screw her in the ass, how, when she went to the bathroom, he told Aaron he'd better have his ear checked for VD. Tell her something. But I didn't have the heart or the guts. I just sat there, looking back at her. And she looked at me, carefully, and then drew a quick breath. Holy fuck. You really do know what I mean, don't you? My old roommate loved to masturbate. He did it at least once a day, often two or three times. Our two-bedroom apartment was small enough that I could hear every rattle of his bed, every shake of his wrist, every word. Fuck, he'd cry out at all hours of the night. Or, hell yeah, that's right. Now, bitch, now. He quickly started taking advantage of my job at a local video store that carried a wide variety of porn. I soon learned to distinguish the sounds of his bed sliding under his weight from the sounds of the couch banging against the living room wall. And as loud as he turned up the TV, he made sure his narration was even louder. Often he would eat a bag of fast food burgers, turn on his latest rental, and chug Bud Light after Bud Light, pointing his can at the girl's breasts and laughing, his mouth full of half-chewed meat. One evening, I looked up from my American history notes and saw him, beer on the TV tray, hamburger in one hand and the other hand in his pants. He ground the meat with his teeth, his eyes growing wider and wider. I moved toward my room, and as I passed the TV, he pulled his penis through his open zipper and continued stroking. He grinned at me. "You like that, don't you?" The yellow stubble above his lip was stained with ketchup, and small bits of meat fell from his mouth onto his stomach as he talked. I kept walking to my room. "Come on, don't you want to watch?" I slammed my door and heard him yelling, "I want you to watch." That night, I woke just as my door swung open. He rushed in, his white t-shirt stained with beer. At first, I didn't realize he was naked from the waist down. I leaned up in my bed, and he shoved me down hard. I tried to get up again, and again he shoved me down. He punched me, in the shoulder, then the leg, growling and spitting with each punch. "This is my cock, fucker. This is my cock." I'd stopped trying to get up, but he kept shoving me, pushing my head against the pillow, pulling at my legs, screaming the whole time, "This is my cock. Look at my cock, goddammit." It hung there, erect, wiggling as he moved, bouncing up each time he flexed to shove me again. He grabbed me by the side and pushed me against the wall. The Led Zeppelin LP I'd nailed above the bed fell and shattered against my head. "This is my cock and you are my pussy. You get it, fucker? This is my cock and you're gonna look when I fucking tell you to look, pussy." After a few minutes, he left my room. But later that night, I heard him slumped outside my door, banging his head against it. I heard the sounds of a beer can being thrown against a wall, and I heard him crying, sobbing, wailing. "Don't leave me. Oh, fuck, please don't leave me. I love you. You can't leave me." He banged his head harder and harder against the door. "I swear, I'll fucking kill myself if you leave me." The next day, he set his TV tray full of tacos aside, started a movie, and pulled down his pants. He grinned that wide grin of his. "You ready to watch?" I said yes. To everyone. Every time. When my wife asked just before we started dating if I was straight, I said yes. When, a few weeks later, she asked if I was a virgin, I said yes. I said yes when she asked if I was okay. First after we'd made love for the first time, and again after I told her about the man and the blanket and the fireworks. I said yes. It's always seemed easier. Because I'm not sure whether I'm gay or straight or bisexual or asexual or antisexual. Because I've only been in one relationship. An opposite-sex relationship with the woman I married. Because I can't understand a sexual identity that doesn't involve rage or terror or power. Because even when I'm attracted to men, male bodies, even my own, it turns my stomach. Especially my own. Because I'm still that 11-year-old boy, and I love to smile, and I want to smile, but that hand is still covering my mouth. So I said yes, I'm okay. Even though to this day, for a moment, my mind leaves the room every time I undress in front of her. Even though I tighten every time she runs her fingers through my pubic hair. Because I love her, and I love making love with her. Even though, after 12 years with her, I still find it hard to initiate sex. Even though, after 12 years, I want her more than ever. But I don't know if I'll ever be able to differentiate that kind of longing from the male eyes I've seen up close. And what if that longing that makes me sick is what she sees in my eyes when I look at her? And I said yes because I'm lucky. Not having a hymen, I've never had to have the difficult discussion about what it means to be a virgin. As a man, I've always been able to control exactly how and if and when my story is told. So I said yes, I'm okay, because I know the statistics, because it only happened once, and because I didn't die by my own hand or anyone else's. because despite every razor blade I've held and then thrown in the garbage, one way or another, I survived. I said yes, because now the nightmares are rare. Because I don't know how to tell the woman that I love that when I dream, death is never the goal. It's just the obvious outcome of trying to carve my body into something less dangerous. I said yes, because I'm sick of using my past as a crutch to explain the present. Because everything feels like being trapped in a spider's web, and at the center is a pair of softball-sized glasses and running cleats and ripped jeans. And I don't know if I'm strong enough to push through the web. But I said yes, because I have to hope someday I will be.
Knowing Better by Samita Mukhopadhyay. By the time I turned 30, I thought I had my shit together. I had managed to turn a life of substitute teaching and hanging out at raves into a career in writing and a day job in media strategy just from the exposure I was getting at a well-known feminist blog. I had just sent in my first print piece for the anthology Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape, edited by Jessica Valenti and Jacqueline Friedman. I was in talks for my first book deal, I was finishing my MA at night, and I was booking my first set of speaking gigs, touring the country to lecture young women about the importance of telling their stories. I had found my voice, and it was resonating with people who didn't even know me. For someone who never thought she would ever have a real career doing anything she actually liked, the possibilities started to seem endless. For once, after decades of bad grades, aimless career ambitions, and rejection from jobs, schools, and boys alike, I felt worthy. But I was also going through a nasty breakup from a toxic relationship fueled by the coke and ecstasy we'd get nearly every weekend at raves, on top of drinking and experimenting with God knows what else. And after the breakup, I started to spiral out. My friend Jessica called it my trampage. I spent it going to parties alone, staying out until 4 a.m. on weeknights, getting drunk, ending up in random beds and having lots of casual, often mediocre, sex. I justified my lifestyle with my politics. I was independent, and independent women could fuck random men without remorse or judgment. I didn't get attached either because I was a cool girl. I'm literally fighting heteronormativity, I told my feminist self, my political identity carefully constructed around defying the norms of what was expected of a straight-ish single woman. I knew better than to get myself raped, but it happened anyway. I met him at a club, and we were dancing and kissing. His name started with a K, but I can't really tell you what it was anymore. I definitely knew at the time. He was tall and handsome, really tall, and I remember telling him I didn't want to have sex. "Should we go to your place?" he asked. "Not tonight," I responded, tipsy. We kept dancing and kissing. It wasn't bad, but I was tired, and I had an early morning. "I just want to smoke a blunt and massage your feet," he asked, sweetly. I giggled, because I always fucking giggle when I get nervous. "Sure," I conceded. At that point, I was pretty drunk. We went back to my place, and we smoked weed. I was still drunk. Normally, I just get the spins. That time, I passed out. I woke up to him penetrating me in my own bed, unclear how he had gotten to that point or when he had gone upstairs to my room. I passed out again. I was in and out of consciousness the rest of the night. In the morning, I fully woke up and he was trying again. I said no and forcefully pushed him off me. I looked away, trying not to cry, and noticed that the fucker had even been considered enough to use condoms. I asked him to leave. I said I had to go to work. I did have to go to work. I did go to work. Somehow. Numb, with something more than a hangover, I texted my best friend and said that I had an intense night with some dude. She just said, "Oh, girl," unsurprised to get another text like that from me. I was a feminist activist and writer and thought leader. I knew better. That wasn't rape. That was just some shitty sex. I would shake it off. I didn't talk about it again for a year. A year later, I was thumbing through the anthology my first essay was in, Yes Means Yes, when I saw LaToya Peterson's essay, The Not Rape Rape. But instead of being excited about being included in a special project, about having my first byline in a book, about being